full mu'mineen, because we have alif,
right.
Alif lam wasl, hamzatul wasl. So this salihul mu'mineen, which is in the plural form, it is salihun al mu'mineen.
Right. But people because, who know tajweed will understand this example.
Yeah,
right.
I hope it's not that too much complicated. So salihul mu'mineen, this bab is written. I mean, nowadays it is written, but it's not pronounced.
It's not pronounced.
But in that time, according to, I mean, some ways of writing, waw was also omitted. So it was written like Salih al-Mu'mineen. And this is another cause that later people who tried to recite this verse, they didn't know whether it is Salih al-Mu'mineen, in, I mean, Salih in singular form, or Salihu al-Mu'mineen.
Right.
Plural form, which is another cause for differences of recitation.
Right. That's pretty a pretty big cause, I would
yeah.
say.
Yeah. So, is it related to God? No.
No.
This is one point. That is why I'm referring to the roots of these differences.
It's our fault, basically.
Our fault, exactly. Right. So this is one.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The second reason is that at that time, the Arabic letters did not have any dot. Later,
yes.
I mean, Arabic letters, they had, I mean, dots.
Right. They were added because of, I remember one of the theories was because the Arabs themselves, they knew how to read
exactly.
this.
Exactly. That is the point. And at that time, I mean, the companions of the Prophet, to some
right.
extent, they were not confused how to read the Quran. But imagine that nowadays, if Sin and Sheen are written in the Quran the same, I mean, Sheen
right.
without any dots, we would get confused for, I mean, any letter, whether it is Sin or Sheen.
Right.
But at that time, there was no dot. Or ba, ta, tha, all of them the same. Jim,
no
ha,
dots at
ha,
all.
No dot.
Right, yes.
Sad, dot, the same. Ta, da, the same. Ayn,
so it
ayn.
Was very specialized, localized at that time to
exactly.
only the Arabic speakers.
Yeah, but those people were too professional that as soon as they looked at the words and the sentence, they quickly just could guess whether it is
it was their language after all.
Exactly.
They also wrote this way.
Mm-hmm. But later, I mean, people in the next generations, when, I mean, they wanted to put dots and there was a gap between them. Of course, the Quran is being recited by all the people, but it's very natural that now when you want to add dots to the Noble Book of Quran, such differences happen. For example, we have in a verse, إِن جَاءَكُمْ فَاسِقٌ بِنَبَئٍ فَتَبَيَّنُوا. This is the famous recitation that nowadays we have.
Right. Surat al-Hujurat.
Hujurat. Another recitation of the same verse is instead of fatabayyanu, fatathabbatu. You see the same structure,
right.
the
same
form, but only with the difference of the dots.
Right, which changes the letters and the meaning.
Exactly. Or, for example, we have nunshizuha. Another recitation is nunshiruha. Ra and za. Or, for example, yukaffir ankum, the other is nukaffir ankum. Or, falyawma nunajjika bibadanik, falyawm nunahika bibadanik. You see,
right.
this
yes.
is another reason that later we have such differences in reciting the Quran. The third reason was that at that time, not only we did not have any dot, there was also no vowel like fatha, kasra, dhamma that nowadays we have. So, again, for those people who were very professional, they could guess. For example, imagine alif, ayn, lam, and mim. It can be written, it can be recited as
right.
i'lam.
It can be read different ways.
Yeah, i'lam, you know, I mean, as a kind of imperative
right.
verb. Or a'lamu, I know. Or a'lama, or a'lam in, as af'alu tafdil.
Right.
You see only one word, but without vowels. I mean,
right.
non-Arabs cannot guess.
Without the I'Arab, without the
I'Arab,
vowels.
Yeah.
Right.
So at that time, again, the Quran was written without any vowels. That is why later people, when they wanted to recite the Quran, some of them, they chose different ways of giving fatha, dhamma, kasra.
And we can imagine it would only get worse for people who are not Arabs.
Exactly. So, yeah, we are talking about, Arabic speaking reciters. So, for example, we have the verse, قَالَ أَعْلَمُ أَنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٍ. Some people recite it as أَعْلَمُ, I know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is omnipotent, but some recite it as قَالْ إِعْلَمْ. He said, you know that Allah is omnipotent. It doesn't make a big difference in the meaning, but the point is that at the end of the day, this is a difference in reciting the Quran.
Right.
Or for example, وَلَا تَسْأَلْ عَنْ أَصْحَابِ الْجَحِيمِ, do not ask, or وَلَا تُسْأَلُ, you are not asked. Again, the same word.
Right,
with the same letters, but the point is that about the vowels, whether it is ta or to.
Right,
So this is another reason for differences in recitation of the Quran. The last one is that in that time, Aleph was not written, and that was another big problem. In we know that the Kufi way of writing down the Arabic language was taken somehow from Syriac language. And the way of writing down. And in Syriac, Aleph, when it was at the middle of a word, it was not written. So the same was applied to Kufi way of writing down the verses, and it caused some,
confusion. And misconceptions.
Yeah, I will explain about this one in the following session, and then we'll go to the our main topic, which is about the connection between... But I think we needed to explain about these roots for...
Yes, these introductions, we can have some background information on why this has happened. Just to summarize, dear Sheikh, it is not because we have 10 or 14 different Qurans, the same
not
Quran,
at all. The same,
same
Quran.
Words, but because of the way it was written and kept safeguarded, there has been some confusion and minor differences. And with that, we will end today's program. I thank the dear Sheikh for joining us today and for sharing with us his knowledge. And as always, I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محب لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped. And the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing 2 Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of 5 Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamarshi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the 2 youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation. dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy.
Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled prime minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far, and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The Saudi siege, a war crime and a genocide is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to continue to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the eighth year. Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than airstrikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
The Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations, trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and well-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment. But because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures.
The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For the first time in the history of Pakistan's parliament, the country's parliamentarians chanted death to America as the legislature rejected a no-confidence vote which sought to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, under the heading, Reverse Swing, Imran Khan Outsmarts U.S. Regime Change Plotters. When the leader of a third world country openly and defiantly proclaims his nation's sovereignty and refuses to buckle under the pressure of new imperial powers, the radical sadists and war hawks in Washington resort to their hideous regime change playbook. We witnessed it again recently in Pakistan, but the result was different. Prime Minister Imran Khan, to employ a cricket slang, bowled a vicious reverse swing to thwart what he dubbed a foreign-backed plot. More than 3 years after taking the reins as the Muslim-majority country's prime minister, Imran Khan faced the biggest test of his political career on Sunday, 3rd of April. The opposition, with tacit backing of the country's powerful military, moved a no-trust motion against the cricketer-turned-politician, but the vote was dismissed by the parliament. Deputy Speaker of Pakistan's National Assembly, Qasem Suri, asserted that no foreign power would be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy, calling the vote against the sitting premier unconstitutional under Article 5 of Pakistan's constitution. Qasem Suri's loud announcement was met with vociferous slogans and chaos inside the lower house of Pakistan's parliament. There were anti-American slogans as well. In his televised address on the state-run television, Imran Khan congratulated the people of Pakistan and reiterated that the move to overthrow him was a foreign conspiracy. He also requested Pakistani President Arif Alvi to dissolve the parliament, which was done immediately under Article 58 of the Constitution, and called on the nation to gear up for a fresh election. Information Minister Fawad Chaudhary said Imran Khan will continue in his chair until the fresh vote is held, but it remains unclear how things will proceed. Imran Khan won't be completing his full term, something no prime minister has done in the South Asian country's history, but he clearly outsmarted the regime change plotters in Washington. Before the high drama vote on Sunday, the embattled prime minister had rejected calls to step down, vowing to fight until the end. He didn't blame his domestic rivals for plotting his downfall, but claimed a foreign plot behind the move. It was a revelation hard to dismiss, regardless of political affiliations. In an emotional televised speech on Thursday, 31st of March, the flamboyant skipper, who has heroically led Pakistan to its first and only Cricket World Cup triumph in 1992, blasted Washington for ganging up with his political opponents in a bid to remove him from office. Imran Khan referred to a letter received by Pakistan's outgoing ambassador to Washington, Asad Majid Khan, from a senior U.S. State Department official, which was sent to Islamabad on 7th of March, a day before Pakistan's opposition parties made the first move to table a no-trust motion against Imran Khan in the National Assembly. Calling the letter evidence of an international conspiracy to topple his government, Imran Khan affirmed in his speech on Thursday, 31st of March, to an independent country, a message like this that apparently is against the Prime Minister is actually against our nation. According to senior Pakistani journalist Naseem Zahra, the threatening letter warned that the US-Pakistan relations will not improve with Imran Khan in power and that Pakistan will be forgiven only once he's ousted. As Imran Khan rightly said, that pointed to brazen foreign meddling in Pakistan's domestic affairs. It didn't come out of the blue, of course. Before his Thursday speech that made headlines, Imran Khan had also pointed to it at a recent massive public rally in Islamabad. He called the no-confidence vote against him at home a foreign conspiracy, linking it to his recent visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis. The timing of Imran Khan's visit to Russia, just hours before the Kremlin launched a military operation in Ukraine, and his refusal to join the Western bloc in condemning the operation at the United Nations General Assembly, turned him into an overnight villain and outlaw. Imran Khan became the first Pakistani prime minister to visit Moscow in 23 years, showing growing proximity in their bilateral relations. However, what grabbed headlines was the timing of the visit and its immediate aftermath. Quite expectedly, it raised eyebrows in the US and Europe, with Washington even telling Islamabad that it was watching Imran Khan's visit. The message carried a subtle warning: don't get too close to the Russians. Imran Khan, however, chose defiance instead of tame submission. He went a step further when he lashed out at the European Union for asking him to vote against Moscow at the United Nations General Assembly, saying they shouldn't treat Pakistan as their slave. Asking European Union diplomats whether they also wrote such letters to India, their strange neighbour and a strategic rival, the firebrand Prime Minister said at a public rally recently, "What do you think of us? Are we your slaves, that whatever you say we will do?" The warmth between Pakistan and regional powers like Russia and China is a hard pill to swallow for the West, including the United States. Imran Khan, since taking office in 2018, has shown serious intent to forge closer ties with both countries, which has pushed his country away from the United States. Interestingly, Joe Biden is yet to make a call to Imran Khan since taking office in early 2021. It's true that the United States and the European Union are still Pakistan's biggest trading partners, and that's the card they have played for years to keep Islamabad subservient to them. Imran Khan, unlike his predecessors, sought to assert his country's independence in foreign policy and in trade, embracing new all-weather allies like Russia and China. In a February interview, Imran Khan hit out at the United States for using Pakistan for its own strategic goals and then abandoning it and imposing sanctions, citing an example of Pakistan-US relations in the 1980s when the South Union forces were deployed to Afghanistan. It was Pakistan that Americans banked on that time. What has also ruffled feathers in the corridors of power in Washington is Imran Khan's scathing criticism of America's military adventures in neighboring Afghanistan. After the botched exit last August, Imran Khan censured Washington for the mess it was leaving behind in the war-ravaged country after 20 years of fighting. He also refused to allow Pakistan to be used for over-the-horizon U.S. missions against targets in Afghanistan. So it's pretty evident that the aborted move to overthrow him was remotely controlled in a bid to install a US-friendly government in Islamabad. That his political opponents joined hands with the regime change hawks in Washington only smacked of political opportunism and deceit. Imran Khan has been accused of economic mismanagement by his key political opponents, including the likes of Shahbaz Sharif and Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. While it's true that Pakistan grapples with serious economic woes, it will be grossly unfair to lay the blame squarely on Imran Khan and his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. He inherited the mess from his predecessors, who have now conveniently taken up cudgels against him. To his credit, Imran Khan managed to steer the country out of the COVID-19 crisis, combated institutionalized corruption, forged close alliances with both Beijing and Moscow, played a key role in the Afghan peace process, fought the wave of Islamophobia, and amassed the country's foreign reserves to over $18 billion. As Imran Khan declared a few days ago, in a remarkably defiant tone, he will come back with more power, so it will be too naive and too early to write his political obituary.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, well, this is Youth Station. We're here once more from IRB English Radio, and this is Asma. You're hearing me? It's quite a pleasure to be here with you again. Today we're going a bunch of interesting stuff to discuss about, and here with me, I have Brother Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the station.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here again.
Yes, it's such a pleasure to meet you here again. There is an everlasting fight between emotion and what is called logic. Which one you are? A logical person or an emotional?
It's a very tough question. Obviously, it depends on the situation you're in.
On the situation, of course.
So sometimes...
But mostly...
But I would like to think that I'm more logical than emotional. If you're a young person and you want to make a judgment, make sure you keep your emotions away as far as possible, because they...
Which is impossible, of course.
It's not impossible. It's very possible. It's very possible. It just requires a bit of practice. If it was impossible, then I can say to Allah, oh Allah, it's not my fault.
Thinking is prior to emotion.
Of course. See, even, you know how the hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says, إِذَا هَمَمْتَ بِأَمْرٍ فَتَدَبَّرَ عَاقِبَتَهُ.
Yes.
If you want to do an action, think of the consequences. فَإِنْ كَانَ خَيْرًا فَأَقْبِلْ.
But you know, in modern days, it's very difficult, especially for youth, to go for thinking before going for emotions.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's the point. Mm-hmm. We say, as in terms of the plain state, we've been giving the brain to think with. But why do we see a lot of young people moving towards emotional thinking rather than logical thinking? Because we are subjected right now, especially the youth, to a heavy machinery of the West, of especially the media, to make us think emotionally, not logically.
Oh, so you mean there's a propaganda?
Not just propaganda. There's army at work. Shaytan, from the beginning, he made that announcement. He promised Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, لَأَقْعُدَنَّ لَهُمْ صِرَاطَكَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ. In Arabic means what? That you're no longer thinking logically. Mm-hmm. You're thinking what? Emotionally. Why everyone wants to get an iPhone?
Well, maybe because that has some good qualities.
There are so many phones that are half of the price and better in spec-wise, twice as high as the iPhone. A branding.
It's just...
Nice branding, sister. We're buying by brands. We're not buying by logic. Okay, because it's got an Apple logo, I'm paying an extra $1,000 for it. Otherwise, as if I want to think it logically...
So you think that's the whole story and we are being fair now? I mean, you say it's just because of branding.
No. We're saying to you why you're saying why are people and the youth thinking more emotional than logical? I'm saying there's a machine in the background working hard enough to make sure that happens. It triggers emotion. I just give you one example. Branding.
Yes, that was just an example.
Branding is one example where people buy clothes, buy food, buy things based on when they see on ads. What you see on ads is emotional buying, not logical buying.
Let's go for a little break and then we'll be back. Thank you for listening to us and giving your ears and attention.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, I would agree with the first statement you made that we are thinking emotionally. That is, to put it in a better way, I think. I would go with that.
Yeah, so I'm saying...
Yes, the branding is working, but also we see that the quality is good, so I go for it.
No, that's what I'm saying to you. Not always the quality is good. I mean, especially if you want to be like logical about it, if you want to look at the statistics when it comes to the brands that we buy.
Yes.
So sometimes... The product has quality. I don't say they don't have quality.
Yes, I know. It was just an example,
others,
but we are generalizing.
For example,
that.
Okay. And we're saying, for example, for the youth as well. Now, here's the thing. A lot of people don't have money to buy iPhones.
Yes,
what
and
they
here
do
as well.
Is they would go borrow money, put themselves
no,
in debt
that's too much.
To buy an iPhone. So, in front of people, they say, oh, I got an iPhone. Now, is that a logical thinking or
no,
is that
no,
emotional thinking?
No, it's not logical and it's not, I don't know.
If
it's not even emotional.
Okay, so if you look at yourself, and if I look at myself, we make so much of these decisions on a daily basis.
Yes,
that
course.
Are not logical, right? Yes. Why? Because even, let's say, even, I mean, if we're using the branding as one aspect of this brainwashing, if we use that logically, we see I myself a lot of times buy something because I saw the ad says, well, it's good. I don't know if it's good. I've never done the search. Mm-hmm. I just saw the ad, you know, I used like this.
So most of our buying happens based on love at first sight.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm saying. Yes. The point is that we're thinking emotionally. So there's a lot of things. So this is just one aspect. Like I said, branding is one aspect. There are a lot of other aspects that the media is trying to push subconsciously into my and your head through all the media platforms, social media platforms with the youth. Are no longer in control of their own thinking. Someone else is doing the thinking for them.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I mean, especially now we have the Ukraine and Russia war, right? I've seen this, like now this is in the media, where they take a picture of a little girl. I don't know if you've seen this.
Yeah.
That was standing in front of a soldier, and she's defying, being in a defiant state. And now this picture went viral. Millions of people have seen this, commented on it. And this picture was taken a few years back in Palestine.
Oh, God.
Where she's...
Media.
For this little girl, she was opposing as an Israeli soldier.
Oh,
all they
okay.
did is they changed the flag into a Russian flag on the soldier, and they put a flag on the girl as a Ukraine.
Yeah, that's what media does sometimes.
So, exactly. So what's happening to us now is that someone else is doing the thinking for us.
Yes.
So as young people, as youth, we really need to go back to thinking. So as young people, we really need to hit the brakes when it comes to our emotions or thinking. Because our emotions, we need emotions in our life. We need to have sympathy, empathy. We need to have so many things.
Sometimes in order to follow our way, we need the emotion.
No, emotions are needed, but not for thinking. That's what I'm saying. Emotions are needed, but not for thinking. So even for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, when he talks about a wife and a husband relationship, he says, جَعْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً. He put mercy and compassion. Mercy and compassion are two emotional states.
Yes.
You need them in order to coexist with your spouse, but not in thinking. You know,
I
need to be compassionate when my wife makes a mistake. I forgive her. When the husband makes a mistake, she forgives him. Right.
Yes,
so emotions are required in a person's life. Otherwise, he ends up being a rock. But do we need emotions in thinking? Should we be emotional thinkers? That's a big no. That's a red zone.
So this is the Youth Station. We're discussing logic and emotion, which is an everlasting fight. We're just giving you some highlights and some points to note. Well, we talked about emotion. We said that it is good to continue our life. We need that emotion, which is a very strong part of our life. Also, we should consider the very fact that even in Islamic recommendations, we've been asked to go for our thinking at first, and then we could listen to our heart. So at first, the very important thing we have to do throughout our life is to be thinking. At the very first place, you have to give a perfect thinking for every single thing, and then you can do whatever you want with your heart. As a youth, I would say, emotions are very strong. The world has been planned in a way nowadays. Somebody else is thinking for us and giving those emotions, and we could say that those emotions are imposed on us. So now, is there any way for me as a young person to learn how to be more thoughtful than emotional? To learn how to, at first sight, go with thinking, not with emotion? Is there any suggestions you could give us?
It's a true statement that we are strongly, according to statistics or the people in this field, they say 80% of our decision-making is based on emotional triggers. It's not based on logical triggers. So we make that mistake. So we are, and generally speaking, we are emotional creatures.
Exactly.
No. But does that mean we rely on thinking emotionally, or should we try to flip the page?
to improve our character in a way that we go for thinking more than emotion, you know, to control it, to control the balance between them.
So first thing is education. Mm-hmm. Is absolutely vital. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he says, seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave, min al-mahdi ila al-lahad, right? He's highlighting that aspect, that without knowledge, you'll be just like a ball of emotions walking. And every decision that you'll make a mistake, and you will suffer the consequences of it. So knowledge is the foundation of everything. Now, if I'm a logical person, it means I have information, right?
Yes.
If I have no information, I'm no longer a alim, or at least a person with logic. I'm an ignorant.
Yes,
I'm
exactly.
A jahil. So the Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, the Quran always emphasizes on the fact that knowledge is the first thing. If you are not learned as a person, you'll be emotionally thinking, and such thinking will get you in the wrong places.
Yes, and it would be dangerous.
You know, the classical story that Allah gives us in the Quran is Bil'am bin Ba'ura.
Mm-hmm.
Allah says, "Ataynahu min ayatina fansalakha minha." Allah gave him the al-ism al-a'zam, right? Mm-hmm. The name where if he couldn't supplicate it, he can flip the word around. And when Musa was a prophet, Bil'am said, well, it's supposed to be me. He got upset. And then he went to the Jabal, to the mountain, to pray on Musa, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
See, so he lost complete logic here. His information went down to zero.
Yes.
He started using his emotion. His emotion led him to that. And then Allah SWT gave the example of him. مَثَلَهُ كَالْكَلْبِ إِن تَحْمَلْ أَهِيَهُ تَتْرِكَهُ يَلَهُ. What are they? You run after the dog. Or you let him, the dog's always out of breath. The key here is to learn and be a logical person. Without that key, then you're not going to improve anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And also with that, having said that, with knowledge, there are two types of knowledge. We have what we call Almul Abdan wa Almul Adyan. The sciences, you know, that you need in your daily life, maths, physics, chemistry, and the science of religion, which is obviously learning about your faith.
Yes.
Because sometimes we have a lot of doctors in the world right now who worship cows, who worship statues. Now, are these being logical people? So they've taken one aspect of things without looking at the other aspect of it. He thinks he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But if you actually get him to think that why would you worship a cow but then you can bring him other arguments to prove that there are other things better than a cow.
Because usually what takes us away from truth and from logic, we could say it's justification, the ability to justify every single thing we say or do.
Ask the question, where do we start? We start with ilm. We start with knowledge.
Yes, we have
the
to
more you
educate
yourself, the more you're able to process information.
And of course, practice.
Make your own choice. Yeah, obviously, with ilm comes amal.
Yes.
Because
we have to practice that knowledge as well.
Obviously. That's what the Quran says, الَّذِينَ amanu. وَعَمِلُوا You will never see a single verse in the Quran where Allah says آمَنُوا by itself or عَمَلُوا by itself.
Yes, that's
They always
true.
Come hand in hand. So having the knowledge is one thing, practicing it is another thing. So as we say, practice makes
perfect.
Perfect. I know sugar is bad for me.
But still, I would go for it.
As youth, we got so much bad habits that we indulge in. We know they're not good for us.
Yes, exactly.
Whether that's haram habits or whether there are habits where they're just bad for our health. We indulge in them. We just can't stop. Obviously, because what? Because we are not thinking it logically.
Dear listeners, this was all the time that we got to discuss the heart and the mind. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you all.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.